If you drive around and look at the signs that churches put out front, the vast majority of their messages are sort of, we can help you get by, we can help you feel good, here's a pithy little rule of thumb that sounds religious to make you feel better, get you through your suffering. But still, in the end, it's the individual believer who's in the driver's seat.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, we're talking with Dr. Christian Smith, author of Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Well, we have a privilege of talking again with Dr. Christian Smith about his new book, Souls in Transition. Dr. Smith is the William Kennan Jr. Professor of Sociology and director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Society at the University of Notre Dame. He's written a number of books on the sociology of American religion. The book with which most of our listeners will be pretty familiar by now is Soul Searching, The Spirituality of America's Teens. And if you've heard us talk about moralistic therapeutic deism one or two times on this program, it's the term coined by Professor Smith. So it's a pleasure to have you on the program again.
Thanks for having me.
And the latest book is Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults. So this book is a follow-up going up the generation to the parents of the people you studied in the last book?
No, actually, this book is the same youth who we studied in Soul Searching, who we tracked as they grew older, and this is reporting on them 5 years later.
Wow.
That was going to be my question as to, this seems like the natural next phase for those that you studied in the last book.
Yes, that's right. This research project we have is longitudinal, or what we call a panel study, meaning we have a sample of teenagers that we are following, and we're watching them grow up, and this book is based on the third wave when that group of teenagers has grown up to be 18 to 23.
Could you once again summarize for us moralistic therapeutic deism, because that comes up again in this book?
Yes. Moralistic therapeutic deism is what I saw as the actual functional de facto religious faith of most American teenagers, whatever their formal religious background or tradition is. And what we heard them say, the basic idea is that a God exists, God created the world, God wants people to be nice and fair and good to each other, and that's what the Bible and all world religions teach. The point of life is to be happy and satisfied. God doesn't really need to be involved in your everyday life in any way until you have a problem or trouble, and then you can call on God to sort of swoop in and help you out to take care of your troubles or problems. And that there is an afterlife, that there's a heaven, and who goes to heaven are good people, and most everybody's good.
Mm. Before we get to the actual views and beliefs of the people you studied, help us understand, first of all, what is an emerging adult?
This term emerging adult was coined by a psychologist at Clark University named Jeffrey Arnett, and I basically use his idea. The idea is that in the last numerous decades, a new phase of the American life course has developed that is situated between the teenage years and the fully settled down adult years. So you can imagine sort of an ideal type young person in the 50s, let's say, graduated from high school, married his or her sweetheart, got a job in the factory or the office nearby, maybe started to have kids soon, settled into their career, saved up money and bought a small house. In the past, you would go pretty quickly from high school to being a settled down adult. Well, a number of social and cultural forces in the last decades have changed that, so that now we have this life period between the ages that we count 18 and 29, let's say, called emerging adulthood, where you're no longer a teenager, you're sort of emerging into adulthood, but you're not really a fully settled down adult, meaning married, kids, have your own house, have a real career. And this phase of the life course, which is 10 years or more, it's characterized by a lot of freedom, exploration, uncertainty, feeling in limbo, a lot of experimentation, a lot of sort of hitting the restart button. You try this job, it doesn't work. Try different majors in college, etc. So in other words, in the United States, if you're growing up after your teenage years, you have a very long stretch now that's kind of open-ended, where there aren't a lot of clear boundaries or rules, and where life consists of having fun, not failing, trying to figure out how to become a full adult, but you really aren't ready to be a full adult yet.
Dr. Smith, I have a 19-year-old son and a 22-year-old son, and all of their friends and girlfriends are at our house constantly. You've just nailed it right down to the... I'm just grinning from ear to ear, man. I know that. Oh,
yeah, I have a 25-year-old son, and he still lives at home. I mean, he's a good kid and all, but when I was 25, you know, I was married.
So emerging adulthood is the product of a number of changes converging together. One is the rapid expansion after the Second World War of higher education. So you have a lot more people going to college, and now a lot more of them going on to professional school, graduate school, and so on. Another is a significant delay of first marriage. For men and women, the age of first marriage has delayed 5 years, which is a long time. And considering that some people get married at 19, that means some people are waiting till their 30s to keep the average there. So you have a lot more years before people are married and perhaps procreating. Then you have changes in the economy, which means you don't just get a job as an 18-year-old in an office or the tire factory and keep that for the rest of your life. You know that things are shifting, that technologies are changing, that your job may be moved, that you may need to retool. In other words, all of it works against settling down. That's the core of emerging adulthood. Not settling down for real.
Is it that sociologists like you have studied different transitions in life more, and so we have things to call different periods in a person's life, or does our culture so segment and target people that we now have categories like teenager that it doesn't seem our grandparents or great-grandparents even acknowledged?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. So obviously, people live through the same ages in life. I mean, if you've lived 13 years, you've lived 13 years, whatever your culture calls that. However, the way cultures and societies sort of define those and create norms and expectations around them does change. So being a teenager is very much a mid-20th century invention. And in other societies, when you turn 12, you were sent to a stranger's house to learn how to be a silversmith, let's say. And so these things are culturally variable. And I would say that this period I'm calling emerging adulthood, the structural features of it are, in fact, fairly new in the last, say, 3.5 decades.
Turning now to the religious and spiritual lives of emerging adults, when you look at the massive transitions in people's lives, decisions that young people have to make, trying this, that not working out, trying something else, how does that then come to the church, and where are some of the areas where you see this in the religious lives of young people today?
Yes, there are big implications for churches with the American Life Course. For one thing, most churches are set up that their prime target demographic are nuclear families with children. I mean, this is evangelical, mainline, Catholic, etc. churches all are oriented primarily toward families. So divorced people, single people, et cetera, don't fit in as well, or they feel like they don't fit in as well. And emerging adults especially, they think that they've graduated from confirmation class, let's say. Most of them would say faith doesn't have too much to do with their lives right now. Part of that is they're so preoccupied with transition. It's a very self-focused time. I'm not saying it's necessarily selfish, but just the nature of the life course at this time in emerging adulthood, very self-focused. And the very fact that it's defined by postponing settling down means that the roots are shallow. And so if you think about sort of a faithful Christian life as one of looking in the long term, making commitments, sticking with your commitments, investing in a congregation, working out a faithful marriage, say all those things have to do with settling down, making commitments. Emerging adulthood is about the exact opposite. And so it's very hard for emerging adults to imagine themselves doing sort of a standard faithful religious life. And it's hard for religious congregations to figure out how to deal with emerging adults because they're so transient and hard to connect with.
In light of what you just said, you mentioned that there's a self-focus, which is not necessarily selfishness. But I tend to wonder, if you contrast this group of young adults with that same age group, say 40, 50 years ago, wouldn't you say there would probably be more of a sense of community and a sense of commitment to another group? The whole purpose of starting a family, you know, connection to a family, community, getting a vocation early on so that you can make a contribution, where it seems as if, even though it's obviously the individuals involved, it seems as if this generation, this emergent adult, they are more focused not so much on a contribution that can be made to a community, but just self. It seems to be more self-centered rather than community-centered. And therefore, since they are more self-centered, they take more time in terms of finding that comfort level, and everything is, it seems to be filtered through the me rather than the we.
So, yes, exactly. So if you go back to, say, the Depression or World War II generation, the conditions did not exist for you to spend 10 years figuring yourself out, right?
Exactly.
So
yeah,
there are big generational changes here, and I do think the baby boomers were sort of the pivotal generation in all this. And so a lot of the cultural forces, the marketing, the advertising, the narratives in the media, all sorts of cultural forces do set up to tell young people, you're the center of the universe, you are the thing that matters most to you, etc., which does sort of cultivate a kind of a self-centeredness, yes.
Professor Smith, in terms of the socialization that young people get in the church today, did you see in your findings a contrast between a process of learning your faith, you know, baptism, catechesis, being around Christians largely in the same church you grew up in, and what we are seeing today, where people often can go from nursery to campus ministry and never have actually been integrated and incorporated into the life of the church?
Yeah. There's one chapter in this book that uses very good survey data going back to the early 70s. And basically the punchline of that chapter is there is not a lot of observable decline in the religiousness of this age group. We know that this age group, but this has been this way since at least the 70s, is the least religious of all age groups in American culture. But there hasn't been a huge observable decline in at least things like stated importance of faith, frequency of prayer, church attendance, and so on. At the same time, I would say a lot of those survey measures don't capture some of the things that you're talking about that are more subtle in terms of programming and culture inside of congregations and so on. So my distinct impression is that there's a little bit more of a loosey-goosey sense in how people are raised in congregations today, in part because there's less of a conviction that we actually know what's true, that we definitely want our children to grow up the way we were, you know, because they need to choose for themselves, and so on. So I think it's undeniable that there are long-term cultural changes at work here. At the same time, I would say, if you recall from soul searching, one of the most important findings was the importance of parents in shaping and forming their children. And that continued to be a finding in this book, Souls in Transition. Even after the kids have left home, out of tons of variables, the second most important factor in forming what the religious and spiritual lives of 18 to 23-year-olds looked like was the faith lives of their parents back when they were teenagers.
So if their parents don't know what they believe and why they believe it, why would you expect the...
Yeah, the parents are absolutely central in all this. And so, again, as the theme was then, you know, if we see trouble, if we see something troubling among young people, it's probably because the generation that's raising them have something troubling going on. Now, the positive view of that is it's not like all emerging adults are a mess or doomed. We counted about 15% that we called committed traditionalists who are very serious about their faith. They know what they believe. They practice it. They work on being consistent. They're pretty impressive. They tend to be evangelical or Black Protestant or Mormon. And they, again, because they've had parents that have raised them that way. So there isn't one size fits all for emerging adults. We're talking about tendencies. But it's certainly possible for 18 to 23-year-olds to be quite impressive in their faith.
In the beginning of your book, you introduce Brad, June, and Amanda, who serve as templates for different kinds of emerging adults. Concerning Brad, you write, "Does the leadership of Brad's evangelical church realize how relatively uncommitted and indifferent he is when it comes to his religious faith and practice. Is American Christianity really about personally enjoying sermons on occasion? His views and his attitudes toward truth and other things seem to be relatively similar to someone who isn't raised in the church at all.
Yeah, Brad is an interesting case. He somewhat blew me away because he's not unchurched. I mean, he goes to church fairly regularly, an evangelical vineyard church, actually, and he basically likes it. But when you get down to it, he's the one who's totally in charge of whatever he's going to believe or whatever he's going to do. Church is a nice family thing that you fit in if it's convenient, and it has absolutely no authority in his life to form him. It's just another sort of lifestyle accoutrement that partly because his wife likes to go there. So here's a young evangelical going to a vineyard church who's cohabiting with his wife and goes camping instead of church whenever he feels like it. And on the surface, he probably looks like a great guy sitting there in the pew or the movable chair, but do people in that church really know what's going on?
Now, of the three, Amanda is probably the most religiously involved, yet you quote her as saying, "For me personally, I choose not to go to church sometimes because I need the sleep. There's a certain amount of value in hearing the pastor speak too, who's gone to school and studied the Bible and had that wisdom and knowledge that he can share. So I think there's a balance there." That's religious commitment in our day.
Yeah, so even among some of the most serious, conservative, traditional, committed, emerging adults, you detect language and strains of thought and assumption that are like that. So another girl, she's a missionary in Peru. You know, she does things like that, but she basically talks in pretty relativistic terms. For me, I feel called to be a missionary and to love God, but, you know, other people can do whatever, and it's really the underlying it is the assumption individuals decide for themselves what is true.
So we're back to the moralistic therapeutic deism. God is a resource, but God is certainly not the one calling the shots and around whom everything is revolving.
Yes. If you look at all this through the lens of authority, which I think is a pretty good one, you come to see that for the vast majority of American religion, including Christianity, basically, church exists to help me feel better, to get by in life, to give me a local community. It has this therapeutic aspect to it. If you drive around and look at the signs that churches put out front, the vast majority of their messages are sort of, we can help you get by, we can help you feel good. Here's a pithy little rule of thumb that sounds religious to make you feel better, get you through your suffering. But still, in the end, it's the individual believer who's in the driver's seat.
So not a huge understanding of sin and grace.
No, neither.
When I grew up, there was a lot of theme of avoiding worldliness, and it was definable in terms of smoke and alcohol and theaters. But if I'm understanding one of your themes here, it's naive to think that the church cannot warn against the corrosive nature of the culture in which we live, and primarily I'm thinking of the way in which we think, that would be worthwhile for a church to say, I'm going to do verses on worldliness, but it's probably not going to sound the same as what your parents heard in their day.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's definitely the case. And, I mean, even the language of worldliness sounds quite antiquated at this point. I can imagine
sure does.
A lot of pastors who have that idea in mind just trying to struggle for different words to use to try to describe
sure.
it. I mean, part of it is the situation of American evangelicals in the 20th century is the following. On the one hand, they were against liberal Protestants, and so they wanted to be conservative and orthodox. But on the other hand, they were against fundamentalists. They didn't want to be reactionary. They didn't want to be sectarian. They didn't want to be narrow. And the defining the evangelical self against being a fundamentalist had the effect of pushing evangelicals toward greater involvement in the world, greater enjoyment of the things that society has to offer. And that starts to move in the direction of what makes evangelicals distinctive at all,
sure,
other than you're not a liberal,
sure,
theologically.
Uh-huh. Professor Smith, I pastor a medium-sized confessional Reformed church in the middle of Orange County. And I recognize in your emerging adult category, I see that in the congregation. But, you know, I'm curious. I see that same person who appears to be in the church like Brad, who appears to be connected, but who really isn't. I see more of them in the 30 and 40-year-old age bracket than I do in the young adult bracket. Has anybody done any work in that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Emerging adulthood didn't just arrive. It's been around for a couple decades. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's developing over time. So people in their 30s and maybe even early 40s lived through the earlier era of the development of emerging adulthood. So they once were emerging adults. The obvious thing to realize is if you've spent 10 years as in emerging adult culture and it has shaped you, just because you get married and get a real job and have a baby doesn't mean you're going to become a different person. Many of those same values and outlooks and assumptions will carry on the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Having children has a way of sobering you up to reality, of course, but still some of these things I think will continue on in people's lives. So in theory, unless there's some major other social change, you know, you'll have 60-year-old people who have traces of emerging adult outlooks.
Am I correct in following up that having kids seems to be the major cause of the change in attitude?
At the stage that we were looking at 18 to 23, the one factor that we noticed again and again that really seriously changed direction for people was getting pregnant. Usually it was for the female having a baby, sometimes for the male. Now, when you're 18 or 23 and you're used to doing drugs and driving drunk and then you have a baby, that really is a big dash of cold water in the face. By the time people get into their later 20s and 30s, that effect may be different. But at this age, yeah. I mean, becoming a parent is a major intervention terminating emerging adulthood culture.
Well, I want to piggyback on Rod's question about the correlation to worldliness in times past, because I think what you described, Dr. Smith, especially as you gave samples of some of the sermons that people are exposed to, that the church is unable to be a resource for this generation because the church is being worldly without knowing it, because those categories of how to do, how to become, how to get, it really unwittingly feeds that self-centeredness that this generation or this group, these emergent young adults, that they are used to. So that your whole concept of moralistic therapeutic deism is really the diet that is feeding as well as fueling this generation with their self-centered pursuits.
No, I think that's right. And including, as you're saying, it's not just out there in the quote-unquote world. I mean, it's the churches and church cultures are affected.
And yeah, one of the reasons I think that the church isn't able to give them a different paradigm or a different model is because the church is itself buying into that worldly model. They're not calling it worldliness. They think they're being relevant. But actually what it is it's a different mindset and a different worldview that's fostered by the church. And so it makes sense to the emergent young adults, but they're looking for something different.
Yeah, that's right. And so, I mean, that's what you're saying is the church now, as opposed to, say, the 1920s, needs to get much more sophisticated about its understanding of what is worldly or what is potentially insidious in the culture. I mean, if you go back to prior generations, saying being worldly is shooting pool, smoking, playing cards, and wearing makeup, well, that's not a big deal anymore. I mean, and if that's the definition, then everybody's fine. If, on the other hand, being worldly is, you know, kind of a flat-footed liberalism, well, you deny the virgin birth and the resurrection, well, no evangelicals are doing that, and so the playing feels very safe. But what you're pointing out is there are more threatening and corrosive and insidious ways that worldliness can work its way in, so they feel completely natural in what appears to be a good evangelical church.
Exactly.
So when you have, particularly in evangelical circles, a strong doctrinal statement on a lot of those issues you mentioned, and yet you ask the average person, as we've done on the program a number of times with surveys, ad hoc surveys, even at conservative Christian colleges, and the young people cannot tell you the basics about what they believe concerning creation, fall, redemption, Christ's person and work, that disconnect means that ultimately we're going to end up with the same outcome as if sort of liberalism had swept evangelicalism?
Yeah, functionally, perhaps. I mean, in other words, nobody's denying the truth. It's just not on the radar screen particularly, which is perhaps a more troubling version of it.
Now, that's what seemed to pop up again and again. it's not that it's being denied necessarily, but that historic Christianity isn't being taught.
Yeah. So we took emerging adults, and we, after doing a lot of research on them, we tried to sort them out into different categories of types when it came to religion. And there's not just one type or one scale upon which, from, say, a 1 to 10, an emerging adult falls. There are these different cultural categories. I already mentioned committed traditionalists. At the far extreme are totally irreverent skeptics. And so about 10% of emerging adults. Now, remember, there weren't any of these during the teenage years. So about one from the teenage years to emerging adult years, over 5 years, about 1 in 10 became overtly hostile and skeptical. But that's at the extreme. The vast majority in the middle are either what we call selective adherents. That is, they're perfectly for their faith, but they're just going to pick and choose what they want to believe and practice of it. Or just indifferent. They're not against it. They don't deny it. Religion is fine. But it's just not at all relevant to them, or they don't think it's relevant to them any more than, say, buying a big life insurance package. Yeah. That just feels like it's something that you do at a different time in life, not when you're an emerging adult. So that is a huge bulk of 18 to 23-year-olds are indifferent or selective adherents.
You know, it reminds me of talking one time years ago to a Campus Crusade guy who had gone through all of the training, and at the end of it, he said to himself, there's got to be more to it than this. And he ended up going Roman Catholic to get into a culture that wasn't the same as the one he was walking in every day.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry he took that as the answer, but I totally understand his attitude of there's got to be more to it than this.
Yeah. Evangelicalism turns out, for people that are really trying to dig deep, American evangelicalism, not all of it, but an awful lot of it, is pretty thin.
Yep.
And it doesn't go very far. And if you start to catch on to sort of my individualistic subjective feeling, is only going to carry me so far, and in the end it really doesn't matter. In a lot of circles, that's the center of things, your individualistic subjective feeling. And so, and yet, as you were saying earlier, the larger culture sort of promotes that. So the whole idea that, well, you should learn the Westminster Confession of Faith, or you should know doctrine, that all feels, I think, instinctively, even if they don't think about it, to emerging adults, given the larger culture, that all feels very modern. And I'm not big on postmodernism, but I think there are dimensions where they just don't believe anymore at some gut level in truths and truth claims. And it's just, you know, you don't know what's true, who knows, and you just sort of configure your life that seems to work for you. And that's all there seems to be.
Boy, it's a terrible testimony to the church that we would lose 10% of that group that started out so strong in their churches. But at the same time, I think that 10% represents a group that, if the church really did its job, those are the ones that are probably easier to reach than the vast majority that fall in the middle, that are ho-hum about what they believe, and it, you know, really doesn't matter. Because that 10% represents those, at least from what I'm hearing, those who have tried the church and have found it wanting. Wanting because the church has reflected a worldview and a mindset towards truth that is reflective of the world rather than of historic Christianity.
Yeah. Now, just to be clear, I don't want to be unclear on this, that 10% of the actively skeptical, the irreligious we call them, they didn't necessarily start off as teenagers as religious. Some of them did. Some of them were not religious as teenagers, but they were more friendly toward religion.
Okay.
As they've grown older, they've become more actively hostile, critical, skeptical. How much of that is the new atheist influence? I don't know. Some of them will actually know about, you know, Dawkins and Hitchens. But another thing that our study showed that confirms what some previous studies had already pointed to is there has actually been a shift in the effect of going to college on religious faith, where it was pretty clear and consistent in the research that up until the mid-90s, going to college had a corrosive effect on religious faith. It didn't help people's faith. For some reason, starting in the 90s, that effect has disappeared. The role of college in all this is starting to change. I'm not saying that college is building a robust and well-informed faith.
Sure.
But it simply doesn't seem to be having the same atheizing effect that it did in the past. Some of that may very well be postmodern culture, where in college you learn it's all relative, just whatever you want to do, it's fine, and so on and so on.
You've, I'm sure, have an opinion about the reports of falling off from church attendance among evangelicals. I've heard numbers as high as 80% of evangelical young people being unchurched by their sophomore year in college. What do you think is a better number there?
All right, look, the whole world is terrible with statistics. I mean, unfortunately, everywhere you go, people use and misuse and abuse.
95% of people who use statistics are wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Or 87.5% of statistics are bunk. But so it's not just evangelicals, but it is, including evangelicals, do use statistics, I think, pretty badly to create alarm sometimes, to generate worry. And it's not that people shouldn't be worried, but we should also be telling the truth as best we can understand it. So I think some of those statistics, I've dug into some of them, and just I don't think the methods behind them are accurate. But we do know, however, that there is significant decline in religiosity, let's say. I don't like that word, but we'll just use that jargon, after the teenage years into emerging adult years. But the reality is our study shows there's actually more continuity than there is decline.
Interesting.
More than half end up looking at age 18 to 23 exactly what they looked like religiously as a teenager. Now, that may be highly religious or moderately religious or not religious, but the bottom line is for most, nothing changes. Only about 30-some percent have a decline in their religiousness, and that can be a shallow decline or it can be a steep decline. But about 7% actually increase. These are kids, as teenagers, are in not religious households. They either come across inner varsity or they get pregnant and realize they need to get their lives together or whatever, and they become much more religious. So things are heading in different directions. I think it's oversimplistic to say everything's going to hell in a handbasket after age 18. Here's the most important thing. What gets laid down in the childhood and teenage years is most likely going to stick over time into the future. That's the default.
Yeah, I think of my grandparents' generation saying, yeah, I'm a Presbyterian or I'm a Baptist or I'm Roman Catholic, as a way of saying that is my identity. And you weren't quite sure sometimes if they had a vital personal faith in Christ. But now it seems like it's just the reverse. Instead of perhaps having a high commitment to church membership, church attendance, identification with a particular church and denomination, but not necessarily vital personal faith, it's reversed. Vital personal faith can be had without any identification at all with the church. And if that's true, again, I'm wondering, is that because they can go from nursery school to campus ministry without ever having actually been baptized and incorporated into the life of the church?
Some of that I would agree with, and some I would qualify. We actually looked explicitly at this question of how many young, emerging adults are subjectively, in their personal faith lives, really strong, but they're not practicing it outwardly. And it turns out there aren't that many. In other words, it actually, and maybe this is comforting to you or not, but it comes as a package. When young people have a vibrant personal life of faith, they actually act on that in public ways. They go to church. They are involved in things. And so we think that a lot of people, when they look at the disengagement from faith communities of emerging adults, take comfort in the idea that, well, they don't go to church, but they're very serious and committed subjectively in their personal life. And basically what we're saying is they're not. If they are committed, then they do the whole package. If they're not, then they don't. That's one response. The other is, you're right about having very few bearings with regard to faith traditions or denominations. So you can't ask on a survey, you know, what denomination is your church a part of? I mean, they don't know what Protestant means. They don't know if they're Methodist. They may know the name of their church, or they may not. The best you can do is ask them where they go to church, and then you look up what denomination that is.
Interesting. And even then, you're not quite sure.
I do think it's connected to what you're talking about, that it's possible to go from birth through, you know, graduate school in a lot of religious communities and not really have any focus on who we are, what we believe exactly, why we believe it, what our history is, why we're committed to this, and so on.
The book is Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults, published by Oxford University Press, hot off the press, written by Christian Smith with Patricia Snell. Thanks again, Professor Smith, for helping us out and understanding these things.
Oh, you're welcome. It's fun talking.
All right. Take care.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
One of the things that stands out again, as in his earlier book, is the tragedy of churches not doing their job.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Families.
Yeah. We often talk about not only seeking the lost, but keeping those that we bring in. His numbers indicate that the churches are not doing a good job, number one, of discipling and strengthening those that are within, but secondly, keeping them. We're even losing them while they're in the pews if the goal is to bring them to a full knowledge of Christ.
And it's in the name of mission. This is the thing that really frustrates me, that this niche segmentation is in an effort to reach people of this age.
Yeah.
That niche segmentation, whatever goes on there, uh-huh. is so unlike
yep.
right.
what used to happen in terms of preparing people for Christian adulthood.
Right.
That well, it's not a surprise that when they reach that stage, they aren't Christian.
The families that invest time in catechizing their kids, especially when the parents engage in that with the children, whether it's over dinner or at bedtime or whatever, the more time spent on that, the better, because not only do the kids learn the faith and have the categories, but it opens up a dialogue about the most fundamental things in life where the family gets used to talking about truth claims and the kids will ask questions and the parents yeah, hopefully yes. can not put them down for having the question. It just starts this not only learning the categories and learning the data, but it starts a dialogue wherein the parents and the kids are able to talk about eternal things. And should something come up, somebody say something contrary, or one of the kids have an issue, the furniture is in place to deal with that in a right. way in which it's not there if you don't invest that time.
Right. And my wife and I have all sorts of unfaithfulness in this area, but the catechism makes it possible for us to be much
stronger than you
stronger
really are.
Stronger than we really are.
Yes, yeah. absolutely.
I'll give you an example. Just yesterday, one of my sons, 6 years old, asks, if we're all born with original sin, then is it possible for me to go to heaven if my sins aren't on Jesus, and will they ever be brought back on me? Now, why did he ask that question? He didn't ask that question at 6 years old because he'd been through life experiences.
Wasn't on Sesame Street.
Right, right.
And he didn't learn it up from Sesame Street, and he didn't have an experience at summer camp.
Yeah.
He learned categories that he had been thinking about all day, and he's not yet at the stage where he's questioning it or whether right. he's asking, how do you know that that's true? He right. will reach that stage.
Right.
But right now, he's just soaking up the categories. Well, at least there is something to reject if you walk away from the faith
right,
at that
right.
point in your teenage or emerging adult years. Today, the problem is you have all kinds of people who claim to be Christians, but they don't have anything to reject. It's not that they have to walk away from the mm-hmm. faith. They've never really been in it.
Yes.
Well
yes.
There's something about the process of catechism, ideally, where it's fathers talking to their children.
Yeah.
Sure.
They just start something and, that is yeah. just, you can't put a value on how.
It's so confirmed
yeah.
by
yeah.
those articles in Touchstone magazine, the incredible effect of fathers attending a parish.
Mm,
is
yeah.
he able to dissect it? No, but the stats are amazing.
Yeah.
Even if the attendance is really, really pretty sloppy, the effect is overwhelming
yeah.
on the children.
A friend of mine says it's like tying your shoes, integrating your faith with your reason and your knowledge of the world. The strings have to be equal to be able to tie them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can
the number of adults that we have that are operating at a highly sophisticated level every day in the lab or office.
Mm-hmm.
But in catechesis, they're about fourth grade. There's not a chance when you get into college if that's all we've equipped them with. And you compare that with the prior generation, some of the greats at Westminster Seminary or some of the ones at our seminaries, who in their day wrote, I was never fully myself until I was in college and was able to use mm-hmm. what I was catechized into at a very mm-hmm. young age and didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
But the claim is that my world hung together or the center held in a way that it wouldn't have had my parents yeah. not catechized me. In other words, they were arguing fit or explanatory grid for historic Christianity in a way that they were able to say, had I not had the grid, mm-hmm. I would have perished in college.
Well, and, you know, we've been talking a lot about the importance of catechesis, teaching, learning the faith, and so forth. It's certainly not just a matter of memorizing the facts, getting it down.
No.
I think of...
That's part of it.
The socialization is so important here that we grow up in a church. We actually know the older people in the church. I think of a conference a while ago, a youth pastor, I was making some of these comments about the importance, basically, of incorporating people into the life of the church early on. And a youth pastor said, look, I know what my kids need. I know what their interests are. I know what they need, their particular needs of their generation. And he was talking like a marketing guy mm-hmm. who knew this niche demographic like no one else. And I said, about how much older are you than the kids in your youth group? And he said, oh, well, I guess average about maybe 6 or 7 years mm-hmm. older than they are.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm just going to throw this out for conversation, mm-hmm. but if they're around guys like you before they go off to college and only guys like you and their peers, what's going to happen when they get married and they run into trouble in their marriage? What's going to happen when someone in their family dies and they don't know what to deal with it, or perhaps they are diagnosed with cancer? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it have been nice if they had been raised around an 80-year-old couple mm. that had almost gotten a divorce twice, and they're still together, loving each other more now than they used to, but they still have troubles?
Yeah.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice to be able to watch them and to ask them questions, maybe get on the phone and call Elmer and ask him, how did you and Maude do that? What?
Yeah.
What? And then hear him say, we didn't, God did.
Yeah.
Aren't things like that far more significant in the life of a 13-year-old, an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old than a guy who really, 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 really knows who's hot out there right now on MTV?
Sure.
Well, and I think that point that you made to Christian Smith about how the segmented church, the niche marketing church, serves to, number one, undermine the continuity of the faith as passed down through the generations. But also, I think it kind of fuels and supports the idea of the self-centeredness of that generation, because they're isolated from the larger community.
Sure.
And I thought that was a very important point that churches need to hear. You think you're doing the young people a favor by surrounding them with their peers, but you're really doing them a disservice, especially if we look at the church's role and responsibility in light of scriptures and that community element, which
sure.
is significant.
You know, one of my most significant childhood memories, I probably was maybe 8 or 9. This happened more than once. I remember watching my dad and all of his friends who were Baptists arguing the issue of baptism. And I remember on the formal dining room table, commentaries, 6 different English translations of the New Testament, and I would finally have to be going to bed. The coffee pot was going still, and they were going to be up for another 2 or 3 hours. Mm. Now, my father was not clergy. We've never had clergy in our family. He was a surgeon. Mm. But I was learning from that these things count.
Yes.
That these are important. It wasn't in the church. It was outside the church, and your view of baptism is important. I think I was learning 1,000 things that I didn't realize I was learning.
Probably.
So we can't, even if we're going to a good church, we can't dump our kids off at church. And then we come home and we live fundamentally godless lives.
Yeah. To back that up, there's a fabulous story in A.A. Hodge's biography of Charles Hodge, the famous Princeton theologian. And A. Hodge talks about how, as a young man, what a great thing it was to go into the study after dinner. And Dr. Hodge and all the other pastors would be debating theology, and that's how where he learned to be a theologian.
Same as Robert Preuss.
Yeah, same as
Robert
Dr. Preuss.
Robert Preuss tells the same sorts of stories.
Yeah, see, it's in the atmosphere. And if, you know, it's not just parents, it's extended family members, it's people coming over from church to talk. Mm-hmm. By kids growing up, seeing that adults take these things seriously.
Yes.
They say, why is this important? Why should I, as I grow up, take these things seriously? But if it's not a part of their culture, it's not part of their lives, it's not taken seriously by the adults around them, then they're not going to take it seriously either.
Yep.
Well, we look forward to being with you again next time on The White Horse Inn. Thanks for being with us.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.